You're listening to 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly news digest. Today, Shonda Harris Muhammad has been on Richmond's school board for a short 7 months, but she's already proven to be among the most controversial members in years. Can she weather her latest political mishap, the pot arrest of her husband? School board chair Jeff Bourne tells us why it might be time for her to call it a day. And Richmond is blessed with lots of historical sites, but it has one fewer after a contractor bulldozed a section of the historic Tredegar Canal Wall. Part two of our in-depth examination. Joining us today are 5th District City Councilman Parker Agelasto and Jack Berry, Executive Director of Venture Richmond. But first, here are some of the top headlines happening right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Brittany Tracy, and here's the news. The final report of the Mayoral Breastfeeding Commission was submitted to Mayor Dwight C. Jones on Tuesday. The report took 2 years analyzing breastfeeding resources in Richmond and identifying the populations most in need of outreach and education initiatives, specifically low-income mothers. The report highlights 4 basic recommendations for the continued promotion of breastfeeding as a public health initiative. Commission member Leslie Little, a prenatal yoga instructor, certified childbirth educator, and co-founder of the Maternity Resource Center, Nurture, spoke with Open Source about breastfeeding as a public health initiative with real benefits for mother, child, and society. Not only are there proven beneficial health outcomes from natural, nutritionally optimal mother's milk, but dramatically reduced likelihood of disease for both parties and huge social savings in treatment costs. The American Academy of Pediatricians recommends breastfeeding until baby's first birthday, and Little says that
if 90% of women could breastfeed until that 1 year point, it's been estimated that that would create $17 billion a year in cost savings just for the mothers. When mothers breastfeed, they reduce their own incidence of heart attacks, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and type 2 diabetes and obesity. And suboptimal breastfeeding rates contribute to about $13 billion a year in pediatric costs. So babies that have higher incidences of diarrhea, allergies, asthma, fibs, and including obesity later in life.
Little is also employed by the Virginia Foundation for Healthy Youth's Richmond Healthy Start Initiative. She researches how childhood obesity could be drastically reduced with a simple step, breastfeeding.
If we could enable women to successfully breastfeed, we could save enormous amounts of money and profoundly influence the health of not only the current generation of women, but the future generations of children, not just while they're children, but throughout their lives.
Education is the keystone bridging all 4 recommendations of the Mayoral Commission for Richmond's health systems to become, quote, baby-friendly accredited and training mothers in accordance with the Baby-Friendly Hospital Initiative guidelines, for Richmond businesses to provide lactation support programs and spaces for their employees and patrons, for Richmond healthcare providers in prenatal, postpartum, or child-rearing fields to present coordinated resources and a strong message of support for breastfeeding, and for a social media campaign to provide the public with information on the benefits and importance of breastfeeding. Little says she expects to be involved with the last 2 recommendations, education for expecting families and new mothers, and education for the public.
In order for women to be able to successfully breastfeed, the community has to be supporting her. So making our community aware that this is not just a lifestyle choice, but it's a serious and significant public health issue.
And speaking of educating the community, the Big Latch On, a global event to raise awareness and advocate for breastfeeding, came to Richmond in 2012 and will be back on August 3rd. The event is co-sponsored by all of the major health systems in Richmond, Bon Secours, VCU Medical, and HDA Medical.
Our ultimate goal is to have a dedicated maternity resource center where we're holding classes. And eventually, we hope to have lactation consultants and lactation classes in our facilities. Meantime, we're working on the community engagement piece. So if we can help to highlight issues like breastfeeding and make the general community more aware that this is not just an issue for childbearing families, but it really is a community health issue that we all should be supporting, we'll feel like we've gone a long way to helping breastfeeding and lactation in River City.
Today is the Washington Redskins' second day of their 17-day training camp, right here in Richmond at the Bon Secours Washington Redskins Training Center behind the Science Museum on Broad Street. For more than 2 weeks, Redskins fans will watch their favorite players practice for the upcoming season. Longtime Redskins fan Danny Chambers came from Gaithersburg, Maryland to get a glimpse of his team.
I've been 10 years now, I've been going.
The city is counting on fans like Chambers to bring revenues that will justify the expense of the new training facility. In part, the hope is that these guests will spend money at area restaurants, stay at area hotels, and spend money at local shops. Vonda Hagaday of Amelia County was ecstatic to see her team practice, and when asked about her other plans for the day in the city,
wherever the player's going, I'm gonna try to be there. So I'm gonna try to figure out their schedule, and then I'm gonna try to, you know, get in it.
The city hoped to recoup some of its multi-million-dollar investment in the facility through naming rights, but other than the $6.4 million paid by Bon Secours, the city has had zero luck in soliciting other sponsorship money, according to a report in this week's Style Weekly. Another possible disappointment, this one for fans, could involve getting to the training ground. Available parking is spread out throughout the city, with sporadic shuttle services available to and from the training center. Lee Street, the road that runs behind the Science Museum, will be partially closed for the duration of the training camp because the players and Redskins staff entrance is located off that street. For Richmond Public Media, I'm Cameron Vigliano.
In 1861, Richmond, Virginia, was the ugly epicenter of the American domestic slave trade. History tells us that a war fought over the succeeding 4 years ended this ugly practice, but it didn't. Human trafficking remains very real worldwide. Today, there are more people in bondage than when slavery was still legal. And even in Richmond, the vanquished capital of the Confederacy, men and women still live in bondage. All right, I'm with Joshua Bailey, and he's co-founder and CEO of the Greyhaven Project. It's an organization that, and you can correct me if you need to, provide services to men and women who are victims of human trafficking.
That's right.
And specifically, I guess, probably here in the Richmond metro area.
Yeah.
And you're here to talk a little bit about something you guys are putting on, very special thing that you're doing up at the Robinson Theater tomorrow, or today, tonight.
Yeah, definitely. So today at 7 o'clock, we are screening a documentary called Very Young Girls. It chronicles the journey of multiple teenagers that have been or are currently in situations of commercial sexual exploitation, or what we would call sex trafficking or human trafficking. So it's telling their story and walking through what sometimes their process looks like, getting out of that life and what it looks like for them.
Now, your group, tell me a little bit about Greyhaven.
Yeah, so we started about 3 years ago. And we started with a focus of providing direct care and services for a victim once they get out of trafficking. And so we provide a lot of different services, from counseling to medical care to life and job skills. Basically, we're there to help them rebuild after they've been exploited. And so we kind of stepped up to meet this need that nobody else was in Richmond and Central Virginia, of providing those services. And since then, it's been a pretty neat journey seeing, you know, a lot of hope for the folks we're working with.
Now, this is not your movie. This is a movie that is produced elsewhere?
Yeah, it's actually, it chronicles with an organization called GEMS, which is Girls Education and Mentoring Services, out of New York City.
Similar to what you do?
Yeah, very similar. They focus a little bit more on what's called the domestic minor sex trafficking, which is not, you know, it doesn't include like foreign-born or labor trafficking or anything like that. And they're a phenomenal organization in New York City that does really good work.
Okay, and it follows a couple of girls that have come into the program, or?
Yeah, it follows them through kind of their process, whether they were court-ordered or process of care, basically. And it works a lot with the founder and the staff walking through that journey with them and what they're doing.
This is a difficult topic. People don't really think about America as a place where human trafficking occurs or sex trafficking, but it is a real issue.
Yeah, you know, it is, and we always try and take a kind of a lens of hope with everything that we do, because we recognize it can be really, I mean, honestly, it can be a depressing and daunting issue. If we throw out numbers and statistics and stories, it can be pretty graphic and horrible, but we always try and focus on when we respond, what we can actually do by providing care and services and stuff.
And we do have this here in Richmond, right?
Richmond, Henrico, Chesterfield, Hanover, Charlottesville, D.C., pretty much anywhere in the state that there's people, you can find exploitation.
Which is just sad to hear in 2000, and what year is this, 13?
13, I think.
And it's Friday. All right. Well, Josh, thank you very much. And again, the time for this movie is 7 o'clock?
Yeah, 7 p.m. It'll run to about 8:30, 9 o'clock.
And it's Robinson Theater, which is up in Churchill.
Right there on, I think, Q and 31st Street. Yep.
I believe so. It's a lovely restored theater.
Yeah.
Dealing with a tough topic.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ben.
2 weeks ago, the Richmond chapter of the 48-Hour Film Project asked teams of independent filmmakers and hobbyists to put together a short film in 48 creative, action-packed, and sleepless hours. The 2013 winners of the audience vote, Devoured, P-A-L, At the Photobomber, and Ouroboros, will show in a best-of rescreening at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, August 3rd at the Bird Theater. The Bird is located at 2908 West Carey Street, and tickets are $10. For more information, visit 48hourfilm.com/en/Richmond. In the wake of the recently released Mayoral Breastfeeding Commission's report, and in honor of World Breastfeeding Week, Mayor Dwight C. Jones is encouraging breastfeeding moms to participate in the Big Latch On this Saturday morning, August 3rd, at the Capitol Square Bell Tower, located at the intersection of Franklin and 9th Streets. Registration begins at 9:30, and the latch begins at 10:30. Last year, more than 50 mothers breastfed their children during the international event. Richmond's local Big Latch On event is sponsored by Richmond Action Health Alliance, with participation from Bonsecours and VCU Health Systems. For more information, visit the Facebook event page for Big Latch On RVA.
For a born politician, life can afford a long, sometimes too long, and comfortable elected lifespan. But for some not born with a silver tongue or a keen sense of self-preservation, politics, like real life, can, as Thomas Hobbes wrote, be nasty, brutish, and short. Evince the dramatic story arc of 6th District Richmond School Board member Shonda Harris Muhammad. Since the beginning, she's proven controversial. First, as a vocal member of the city's school redistricting committee, she criticized the previous board for its failure to close schools, and continuing after election with her even louder objections, often invoking God's wrath on her detractors, to revelations that she'd not received the doctorate that she'd previously insisted be used in her title. Undeterred, the former doctor pressed on, just last month making headlines again as agitator in what started out as a seemingly minor dispute between two of her colleagues. This past week, Muhammad was back in the headlines, this time as her house was swarmed by Richmond police. Acting on a tip, RPD raided her home, found at least one marijuana plant, and charged her husband with a felony. The incident raises a number of issues and questions among watchers. Did her squeaky wheel finally get greased by a political rival? Will subsequent condemnation and request that she step down from her post by her fellow board members be heeded? And what does her potentially brief legacy mean for an elected body struggling to rebuild its fragile credibility? I'm with Paul Goldman. He's a former Virginia Democratic Party chairman and also probably one of the city's most skilled political analysts and strategists. And talking a little bit about Shonda's situation here, where do you think she can move here? In terms of where does she have to go politically?
It's interesting to see the mayor and the mayor's allies clearly trying to use this drug bust of her husband to force her out of office, particularly since she supplied the tie-breaking vote that let the mayor's choice for school board, his former aide Jeff Bourne, win, because he only won 5-4. And but they're tossing her under the bus for various reasons. One, they see a chance to put in somebody they can control in that particular seat.
Has she proven herself to be not somebody they could control politically?
Well, of course, you know, she sort of fought back hard when people said that she didn't have a doctorate. And she created a little bit of a argument over that and had to give in. She was one of the instigators of the
Tichy, Shonda.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it, between Tichy and Kim Gray and whatever name you want to put on that little mess. I think most people on the board and probably those in city council and in the mayor's office in the business community, we would not lose any sleep if she was no longer on the school board.
Well, let me ask you to go up to 10,000 feet and look down on Shonda as a politician, a fledgling politician. She so far has this doctorate issue that has hounded her. She was a part of, a party to this other political issue that we just had that got rather ugly between Tichy Pickney-Upp's another member and Kim Gray, yet another school board member. And now we have this. Is this politically survivable at this point, or is this a three strikes?
It would be if the mayor and everybody else treated it like you should. Let's just cut to the chase here. There may be a case against her husband. Last I checked, Constitution still applied here in the city of Richmond. The mayor and others have not quite been able to get rid of that. They're
innocent
working
until?
On it. And so you give the person the benefit of the doubt, number one. Number two, I thought these were Democrats. I thought women were no longer property. She's an independent woman. You may have trouble with her politically, but why is she tarnished by what her husband may have done? I mean, this sounds like what you expect from Republicans, not the liberal Democrats, which they all are. So you have a case where...
Well, forces amassing against her here. Does she have a chance politically to redeem herself?
They're massing against her, and you could say because she doesn't have any political support on the council and in the school board and other places. I get that. You asked whether it was survivable. It would be if she got the benefit of the doubt like you're supposed to have, like the mayor would demand that the shoe was on some other foot. But since she doesn't have any support, really, and she now is under pressure from all sides, she is going to find herself even more isolated than she was. Now, is there a process for forcibly removing a school board member? There is, unknown to most people. There is a process, a petition process, where if you got enough petitions, you could take it to a local judge. However, the standard is pretty tight. And you can't throw somebody off a board because of what her husband may or may not have done. I mean, even in the old days, they knew that wasn't fair. So she could hold her ground legally. Can she do it politically? Would the school board itself and the city council and mayor have the nerve to, and when I say isolate her, put her on no committees, take her off totally? Let's understand, they want to pick a new superintendent. Has to be approved by the school board. School board is split on so many things, 5-4. So getting somebody in her place that was a reliable ally of the mayor, which could happen if you got rid of her, hypothetically, the way it works is the city council gets to appoint the temporary replacement. The way they do it is whichever district is affected, in this case the 6th, they basically go along with whatever the 6th district council woman, in this case Ellen Robinson, would want the mayor's strongest ally. So the mayor sees a way of getting another rock-solid Jones person on the board. He's got several others. Got his son. He's got Jeff. So this is a big break for him, and that's why they're jumping all over her. If it was as a shoe on the other foot, some other person, you'd be hearing all kinds of the Fifth Amendment and everything else, and don't pick on her. There's some double standard here. Richmond, folks, is the same plantation, different owners. If you don't stand up for your own rights, you get bowled over. She's not going to have a lot of support, so she's in a shaky position, but she might be stubborn enough just to hang tough.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you very much for being with us.
Okay. My pleasure.
Paul Goldman, former Democratic Party chairman and local political pundit. I'm with school board chairman Jeffrey Bourne, who's been facing a difficult week this week. Jeff, it's been a tough week.
It has. It's been one that I guess, given our druthers, we'd rather not have dealt with, but we don't get to pick the situations that we deal with, and so we're dealing with it in the best way that we know how.
Shonda seems to have some talent for drawing media attention. In the past, she's had a couple of incidents that have been very high profile, her doctorate or non-doctorate, and then more recently, there was this issue with two other board members who had some sort of a disagreement, and then she seems to have compounded that by making much more of an issue of it than it appears to have been. I don't know, was not at that board meeting. You guys this time have decided to take action.
Well, I think we've grown weary, very weary of these unfortunate distractions that really take our time, attention, and focus away from the extremely important work that we have to do. And so everyone has their limit, and I think this was just one of those ones where we'd had experience before, and so we wanted to make sure that we let our voices be heard quickly and decisively about our feelings and about what our response was to the news.
And your response was this letter that you, or public statement that you issued, that didn't quite call for her to step down, but rather strongly suggested it. It said basically that perhaps with this distraction, it's time to spend time with dealing with that family distraction. Are you calling for her to step down?
Well, I think what we're saying is exactly what we said in the statement, which is we believe that it's in her best interest and our best interest that she focus on her family at this time.
And that seems relatively clear in a fuzzy way. So let's talk a little bit about the history here. This has been something of a challenge. She's been a needy board member, I guess, in a way.
Well, I think all of us have such a deep passion for improving public education in Richmond, and we all have those things that are very, very important to us, and we express those and manifest those passions in different ways. You know, as I've learned over the last 7 months, we're all very unique individuals. You know, my belief is still that we're all centered around the idea, the notion, the goal of making educational outcomes in our school system better in Richmond.
This entire board coming in had a different feel about it than the past two boards, certainly, and I think probably than most of the boards that we've had in recent memory. This board seems to have been made up of people who really did come in with a mind to change things. Has this, I guess, these ongoing issues, lingering issues, have you dealt with them, I guess? Have they affected your ability as a board to move forward with some of the things that you were looking to do?
Well, I think that we're still moving forward and still trying to push for those things that we think need to be done differently. I think the most damaging thing that it's done has been to call into question our integrity, our credibility, and we've eroded and damaged the trust that the community has in us to shepherd the school system.
And that is one of the, I guess, the interesting things about this is this board, there was a perception as you came in that you needed, first of all, to repair the credibility of the board, which had suffered greatly over the past couple of years, and that you were going to be able to. It looked like a board that was made up of fairly serious-minded and, at least in words, committed people who had some real ideas about this. How has this affected your ability to do real things? Have there been things that you have, opportunities that you've missed because now you don't have the credibility to ask for things or to call for things?
Well, I can't point to one concrete example right now that we've not been able to go after, achieve, or work on because of any of these distractions. But what I think it does is we, as you know, have perhaps our most significant decision looming before us, which is to hire the next permanent superintendent. And when things like this happen, I believe it probably gives those candidates that we would want pause because they're, you know, the great unknown is what am I getting myself into if I'm a superintendent candidate and what kind of board am I working with?
So this could limit your ability to find a candidate that you really want, and you might end up with that next guy down or the
sure,
next and guy two or three down even.
Well, I think that that's exactly my fear, is that it will limit our choices. And but I think that's true of everything that we do, how we conduct ourselves as a board. Every meeting, every interaction we have, I think sends a message to both the community and potential superintendent candidates what, you know, type of work environment they would be getting into.
Now, I want to talk about two things, I guess, that are more the politics of this. After the last incident, and this was T.G. Pinckney Epps and Kim Gray had some sort of an altercation or a verbal altercation that then became an internet sensation, I suppose, after Shonda put out some emails and demanded action, and then Tichy followed up with demanding action physically, but then demanding an apology still, and it just kind of turned into this fun snowball. I think one of our local pundits referred to it as the real baby mamas of Richmond in real life, which didn't make, I think, any of the three of them very happy and probably shouldn't have. But after that incident, you formed as a result this committee that's supposed to be looking at your bylaws and specifically at, I guess, the code of conduct as it relates to a board member. First of all, can you explain that
and, sure.
And how it's going to work?
Well, I mean, what the goal is here is to really put in place clear and direct lines and guidance on how board members are supposed to conduct themselves when interacting with each other, the public, when representing the school system. But it goes a step further as well, and it lays out some clear consequences and repercussions if board members fail to adhere to the code of conduct, and it prescribes processes for how the board speaks and how the board admonishes any board member that doesn't comply with the code of conduct.
All right, so now here's the first question about that one is, during the last board, there was an effort to put in place, and this was at the very beginning of that last board's tenure, an effort to put in place a gag, essentially, on individual board members from speaking out on issues that the board had already voted on. The board ended up doing a reverse on that about face. But it was sort of one of these things where it gave a lot of people pause. This, I've heard said from a couple of people that this might be an end run around that and doing or could potentially create a situation where you're doing the same thing. And it's not necessarily something that this current board would do or envision doing, but what about the next board or what about the next chairman?
Sure, and I think that's the risk, and those are the issues that those are the types of issues we're working through before we finalize this policy. I have probably, to my detriment in my time as chair, allowed board members the opportunity, the ability to express themselves about any number of issues, because I believe each of us has a unique voice and a unique perspective, and that will make us better. I think we all understand that. We don't speak for the board unless the board has voted and a majority of the members agreed. But you can speak out. I mean, we're all independently elected. And if you disagree with a decision, my expectation and my hope and my belief is that those board members that may have been on the unsuccessful side would say, you know, the board has spoken. I clearly disagreed. I voted against Measure X. And here's why I disagreed, but the board has spoken. It's time to move forward. And I think that's how deliberative and legislative bodies should work. And I have a high degree of confidence in all of my board members that, you know, they're going to act in the best interest of the school system and themselves. Certain occasions that trust and that belief has been eroded.
I think you still have to approach the job that way, right?
Sure, you do. You have to be sort of an eternal optimist.
It looked to me like in receiving the press release, everybody's name is on there except obviously Shonda. I'm presuming she's not supporting this effort to have her possibly step down. But then you had one other board member whose name was not mentioned on there, and that's
Mamie Taylor. Was that a decision she made, or was she just unable to be reached?
Well, you know, Don and I sat in a conference room for about 4 hours yesterday and worked on this statement, contacting, talking to board members, getting their input. We were able to reach Mamie and read her the statement. She took a few minutes to contemplate, and then she called us back and said she was going to decline to add her name to the statement.
Did she indicate why?
She said she just wasn't comfortable at this time putting her name on that.
Okay, and then I guess the other thing is, and we're already seeing this, I guess Paul Goldman had a piece that he proposed that there was some politics behind this. If not the initial bust, then possibly the actions afterwards. Is there some concern on your part that you know, this is, she's of course been a polarizing character. There's probably a lot of marijuana plants growing on back porches in Richmond, Virginia. So it seems convenient that somebody called about their plant. Do you have any concerns, I guess, as relates to that? And then also just the possibility that this could be perceived as a political maneuver to remove somebody who's polarizing.
I'm not in a position, or I don't have any reason to believe that anybody in the community would be out to get her to this extent. You know, my understanding, having looked at the news media coverage, that, you know, the porch that it was found was on the second story. It's clearly visible from the street, from, you know, over the fence. So it's not as if it were on the front porch where anyone could have dropped it off, or, you know, it's, you know, under a shed.
It's their plant, is what you're saying.
Right. And so, you know, I don't believe that this is, you know, some political conspiracy against Shonda Harris Muhammad.
The next step is, and we're already hearing a little bit about this possibly too, is some sort of a referendum, or not a referendum, excuse me, a recall effort by people in the district. And by the way, we were talking before, this is the district that technically represents the Capitol. So the governor's mansion falls into this district. Are you hearing anything about that? And what would be that process if that moved forward?
You know, I haven't heard anyone from the 6th district say, I'm working on the process to institute
and
this recall.
And with me, it's a lot of, I hear people are already working on
right.
the process.
Right, and so that's what I hear people. Too. And so I don't know enough to even speculate. You know, the process, as I understand it, and you know, it's a certain percentage of the voters, or the votes cast in the last election, signing a petition, and then the process would go on from there.
And then after that removal, if it happened, what would then happen? Well, or for that matter, if she does decide to step down in the next couple of weeks or something, how would a replacement be determined?
Well, I think we would look to the charter, bylaws of the city, general law of the state, and I believe the process would be that we would appoint someone, or perhaps
and these are, as I remember, nominees.
Right, nominees.
You can even nominate yourself.
Right,
I think.
Sure. But I don't want to represent 2 districts, so I won't nominate myself.
yeah, clearly.
but yeah, and so I guess I think if the board can't agree, then I believe the circuit court.
Maybe Doug Connor could represent.
I believe that the circuit court appoints
a replacement
until, I guess, a special election can be held.
So next board meeting, which is, let's see, is it this coming Monday?
August 5th.
Okay, so August 5th, next board meeting. What do you think that's going to look, feel like? Are you concerned about the mood in the room?
You know, I'm not. My hope is that we can, by then, we'll have at least put it further behind us, and we can move on about the business of doing things like getting schools open in 6 weeks, really engaging our search firm for the next permanent superintendent, and you know, the various and other policy matters that we've got to address. Now, that's not to say that a board member won't raise it, you know, we'll deal with that as it comes. I try not to have too high expectations of what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. And that's something certainly that I've learned over the last 7 months.
In previous instances, the board meetings have been used as sort of a pulpit by Ms. Muhammad herself to defend actions. Some couple of famous audio tapes rolling around out on the internet of her defense of her doctorate. This is funny. You're supposed to defend your doctorate, but not in front of the school board. are you going to allow that with this as the chairman, or can you not, or can you prevent that?
I don't think that there will be a platform for that at our next meeting.
All right. And again, Jeffrey Bourne, school board chairman, thank you for being here. Tough week.
Thank you, Chris. This is truly an unfortunate incident, but one that I don't think will prevent us from moving forward.
Well, there's another eight of you that seem to be pretty solidly focused on things.
Absolutely. And, we're 6-7 months into a 4-year term, and, we've got some battle scars already, and they're just going to make us that much stronger and more resolute in our desire to build the best public education system at Richmond we can.
Chicks dig scars. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Don't bogart that joint, my friend. Pass it over to me. Joint, my friend, pass it over to me.
Roll. On last week's episode of Open Source RVA, we presented part one of our discussion about the demolition of a historic wall predating the Civil War near Tredegar Ironworks. After months of silence on the subject, city officials announced last week that it will make J.E. Liesfeld, the Hanover-based contracting company responsible for tearing the wall down, rebuild it at its own expense. The Commonwealth's attorney, Michael Herring, announced that the destruction was an accident, but it doesn't seem like there was much of an investigation into the details. For instance, despite this pronouncement, city residents still don't know who hired Liesfeld in the first place and what they were doing there. And why are city officials and local law enforcement being so lax about getting to the bottom of what happened last October? We're joined today by City Councilman Parker Agelasto. The wall sits in his district, and he's had his own questions about what happened. Welcome. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks, Don.
You were shaking your head. It's not in your district.
The wall technically does not reside in the 5th District.
Oh, okay.
The boundaries of the district go right where 2nd Street connects back to the Lee Memorial Bridge.
Ah.
So the canal does go into the 5th District within about maybe 80 feet, 100 mm-hmm. feet of where the wall was torn down.
Right.
And since Oregon Hill is in the 5th District, and the witnesses and the residents who are most concerned about the wall live in the 5th District.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's why I've been putting my attention.
Gotcha. Well, we heard from some of those residents last week. Scott Berger and Charles Poole, two activists, came up and laid out the case for why this doesn't smell right. We'll be having Jack Berry of Venture Richmond on the program next to talk about Venture's role in all this. But I want to ask you if you're satisfied with the announcement that was made by the Commonwealth Attorney's Office and the police chief. It was just an accident, they say, and all the contractor has to do is rebuild the wall. Shouldn't we have a full accounting of what happened?
I think we should have a full accounting of what happened. I think what the police department and Commonwealth's attorney have now concluded is that from a criminal perspective,
mm-hmm.
that their accounting is complete and
right.
that they don't believe that there was any criminal intent to destroy the wall, and therefore there's no charges to press,
mm-hmm.
and then there's no case to hear.
Right.
So, the charges to press come out of the Richmond Police Department. The case to hear comes out of the Commonwealth's attorney.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Commonwealth's mm-hmm. attorney, Michael Herring, says he doesn't have a case presented to him, he can't hold the hearing.
But if I walk downtown and defaced a monument or historical landmark, do you think I, as a public citizen, would get off with a fine like that? And an investigation doesn't seem to be complete?
I would agree with you on that analysis. And in fact, there are laws on the books that say you do not need criminal intent if you deface a monument. And if you deface Civil War era historical places of significance, mm-hmm. Clearly the question becomes, is the wall a monument? Mm. Is the wall a Civil War era significance place? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that, that the Commonwealth's attorney has had to make sure that they've read the law and, yeah. and you know, I believe when they make a determination that they're using their judgment to provide a conclusion. However, what they've all said is that that's the criminal side of things. There is a civil side. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the city's press secretary has announced that the contractor, Licefield, would rebuild the wall at their own expense. Mm-hmm. There's been no settlement with Licefield.
Oh, okay.
There's been no written agreement as of yet with mm-hmm. Licefield. Mm-hmm. So that, I don't believe, was an accurate statement. As far as I am concerned, any settlement that says you've done something damaging to city property mm-hmm. and there's a fine or there's some remediation that has to occur, mm-hmm. And you're going to probably say, oh, I don't want you to come after me next year, so I need some assurance that the city's going to be done after you agree to this. This settlement, the only agency that has the authority to settle the matter is city council legally. Mm-hmm. So in my conversations with city staff, primarily Byron Marshall, the issue will ultimately have to come before city council to resolve it on a civil settlement.
Gotcha.
And how that's going to look, I don't know. You know, what I have requested is that the members of the city staff who are in contact, not talk to the contractor myself, those who have talked to the contractor who's admitted to this, that they need to work it out. I have said that that we do need an independent analysis of what the cost to rebuild the wall would be mm-hmm. So that we make sure that there's a balanced perspective.
Do we even know who hired the contract?
You know, I don't know if it's a matter of hiring the contractor or not.
I mean, they couldn't have just gone out on their own and said, we're going to do some work out here today.
Well, Don.
You know what I mean?
Some people do some crazy things.
Yeah, but don't you need a key to get in? And, you know, it seems to me we're a city of many permits and laws, but it seems to me this was just like willy-nilly.
From my understanding of a timeline, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that different people have a different understanding of a timeline, but looking at the land parcels, it is a little complicated down in this area because you've got CSX, you've got the city, you've got this other section that was formerly part of Newmarket that then became a gift to Venture Richmond, and then you have the Tredegar American Civil War Center. So you've got a bunch of different parcels kind mm-hmm. of all converging there. What my understanding was that Newmarket had actually hired this company at one point to come in and clear off part of the site. Mm-hmm. They did that. Then Newmarket transferred the land to Venture Richmond. When the land was transferred, apparently there was a section of the wall that the contractor had not cleared. So they decided, oh, this is the time we need to make sure we get in and finish doing what we needed to do to the property line. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes a little bit loosey-goosey is, whose land were they on at that time? Were they still working on the Newmarket land? Were they working on the Venture Richmond land? I believe the deed had already transferred.
Right.
Then
right.
you have the issue of when did they know that they had crossed over into city property mm-hmm. and the city wall? Mm-hmm. That is a question that I think only the contractor would be able to answer.
Right.
So
I just find it weird that we had an investigation, but that very crucial piece of knowledge, who hired them to go out there in the first place, we don't know or we can't find out.
So here's an alternative to who knows what and when. Mm-hmm. As I said, City Council is the only agency with the city that has the authority to create a settlement mm-hmm. with a third party. Council will have to hear some sort of a paper ordinance that drafts the language of that settlement.
Right.
Any ordinance that is heard by City Council becomes a public hearing. This gives those who have additional questions the ability to ask them in a public forum, mm-hmm. Outside of going to media outlets like Open Source. And it puts all of council in a position to understanding, how did this happen? Mm-hmm. Can we prevent it from happening in the future?
Right.
And to make sure that the recourses are appropriate for mm-hmm. what happened.
Gotcha. Now, you said you met with Byron Marshall last week. We've been trying to get a city official up here to talk about this. What is the mindset there about this? Is it just like eye-rolling embarrassment, or what's the feeling? What was his feeling about what happened?
I think, and this is where it truly gets to be try to find the appropriate word to use. I think what we've got to do to be responsible from the city perspective is to make sure that everybody in the city is talking and determining what is the best path forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of people have their own views of what they want to do with that city-owned land.
Yeah.
In the end, there's damage to city-owned property. You need to resolve that. Mm-hmm. Before you move to the next step.
But not only
too
that,
many
but historic property that's been labeled as very historic, and I'd like your thoughts on that too. I mean, we heard from the activists last week that this is a real integral part of our history. This is in our bones, I believe Scott Berger said. Do you agree with that, or do you think that's an overstatement? How would you characterize that?
Clearly, the canal is very historic to the city of Richmond. The canal's use modified over time,
mm-hmm.
So that you ended up having railroad tracks, you ended up having this wall. The wall wasn't original to George Washington's historic James River and Kanawha Canal. So you've got these modifications over time.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize the importance of the core history of the canal, but then at what point is some alteration therefore more important to preserve than another aspect?
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you think, let me give you an analogy. Montpelier up in Orange County, right? The DuPonts eventually owned that house and built all onto it. But more recently, the historic preservationists say, no, let's restore it to its original
mm-hmm.
historic value.
Yeah.
Even though all those additions were, you know, done in the 1920s, 1930s, and they themselves are beautiful and historic because they're associated to the DuPont family.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what is the most intrinsic historical value?
Yeah.
Right? And at some point, you do have to make decisions. What I hear in terms of the wall and rebuilding the wall, and I think this is really something that we all have to come to a determination, and frankly, I would much rather just settle with the contractor and then have this conversation. But everybody feels that the conversation has to be had. But give me 1 second. Venture Richmond owns land adjacent to the city's land. They remove the wall. They don't want the wall. They're not going to rebuild the wall. Then you have the Second Street connector mm-hmm. before you even get to another portion of the wall.
Yeah.
Then you've got the city's property, which goes until you get to the CSX rail line where there's no wall.
Mm-hmm.
So there's currently no wall anywhere west of the Second Street connector. If Venture Richmond's not going to rebuild any section, the city then would be rebuilding a detached, freestanding wall out of non-historic materials mm-hmm. because there's just not substantial enough historic material there to rebuild it with the existing mm-hmm. brick. So at what point is that historical?
Yeah.
It's almost as if
it's like a reenactment. It's a,
it's not even a reenactment. I mean, it's kind of a it's kind of Colonial Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm, right. Okay.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, let me make everybody think that this is historic, but it's really not historic, and it's just standing there. There's going to be no interpretation. So, I'd rather just settle whatever the issue is with the contractor, mm-hmm. and then let the city determine what's best. If the city determines that building the wall is the best thing, if the city determines using those funds that might be part of a settlement to improve the canal path and really make the canal accessible again to people, because mm-hmm. right now, I mean, as you've probably seen it was overgrown and probably not a very safe environment for most people. But let's figure out how to do that after we conclude the the settlement with Licefield. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, we're coming up on 1 year. October's going to be 1 year of the incident.
Yeah.
What I've asked is that we make sure that a settlement is done by September, that council has the opportunity to review it by September.
Right, right.
Because in the end, you want to show that you're being responsible and that you're taking damages to public property seriously.
Mm-hmm. And well, we're going to have Jack Barry on in a bit, but what do you know about Venture Richmond's plans to build an amphitheater in that area? And do you think the plan changes there go too far in encroaching on history and the historical land?
So Jack Barry, about a year ago, presented to the Oregon Hill Neighborhood Association plans to build an amphitheater for the Richmond Folk Festival. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Basically, Newmarket Corporation saying they couldn't use a large open space area and that they would have to find a new home.
Yeah.
They presented, and there were significant concerns about the plan, mm-hmm. largely due to regrading of the canal.
And this was, the concerns came right before this wall came down, right?
True.
Yeah.
True. And as a result of public dialogue and consultation with historians, Venture Richmond has subsequently changed mm-hmm. their plan.
Right. And this was the plan that Jack Barry presented to the association on Tuesday?
So he presented a revised plan on Tuesday.
Right.
You know, my biggest thing is, why move heaven and earth, literally, when for his plan you could essentially raise the stage and gain the sight lines that he was trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. And so he has, in fact, in his new plans, raised the stage so it doesn't have to cut into the embankment as much.
Right.
What his concern, however, now is not so much cutting the embankment for sight lines, but what do you do in terms of safety, mm-hmm. since the public will have access to this? How steep is too steep? If you think about the number of family activities mm-hmm. that go on at Browns Island, and when you think about the folk festival primarily being what they want the site for,
yeah.
that's a family activity. Mm-hmm. And you've got a big grassy area, and you've got your four-year-old who's running, and then all of a sudden they roll into a canal.
Yeah.
You know, he's concerned about that. The plan that he presented, there's still some question about what are the proper widths and heights and all these things of the historic canal, but he's very aware of the sensitivity to preserving it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the revisions at least acknowledge that. The neighborhood on Tuesday had some additional...
Yeah, I had heard that there were some people who still aren't satisfied.
They're still not satisfied. And I think in the end, you have to kind of ask yourself, what can be done to make this area safe,
mm-hmm.
attractive for visitors, accessible, usable?
Have enough alternatives to this amphitheater been explored, do you think? Because that's another sticking point, is that they were awful, you know, quick to rush in and want to do this when maybe there would have been another way or another plot of land they could have used. Any thoughts on that?
The argument that Jack Barry has made for keeping it in this region is the folk festival cannot become a broken across the whole city
yes.
festival.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be aggregate, and it needs to be convenient in one location.
Mm-hmm.
That's the success of the festival. So if you took it to a different site, you know, put it at City Stadium, it's not going to work
yeah.
from that sense of it's a major festival, and
yeah.
you can go from stage to stage to stage and experience different...
Yeah, walkable mm-hmm. festival. Were you concerned at all with the police reaction to all of this? Charles Poole, who reported the demolition as it was happening, claims that police actually impeded him from filing a report. Does the police, and it seemed like the police took an awful long time to talk about this, to even really acknowledge it in many ways. Are you satisfied with their response to how this all went down?
With all respect for Police Chief Tarasovic and his new position, he was not the chief when the incident occurred.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's a challenge when a member of the public comes to report an incident and they are denied the ability to report an incident. Mm-hmm. The notion of a victim is something that the police always consider.
Right.
Who is the victim here?
Yeah.
City property. The city is the victim. Who is the city? Is the city Mayor Jones? Is the city Chief Administrative Officer Byron Marshall? Is the city the nine members of City Council?
Mm-hmm.
Is the city the public?
Right.
And frankly, I think that if a member of the public is witness to something that the city has a grievance and just cause,
mm-hmm.
I think that member of the public has every right to file a complaint and an investigation to benefit the city.
Yeah.
He's not, Mr. Poole's not trying to benefit from this.
Yeah, I don't see how.
He can't. It's city property, and he's simply trying to say, I witnessed
mm-hmm.
somebody trespass and damage property, and I want to report it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the city has to recognize that a citizen has the ability to report vandalism, damage,
I know, it works
crimes.
With crime Stoppers.
And to deny a citizen the right to file a police report, I don't think that was handled appropriately.
Well, Councilman Parker Agelasto, thanks for coming in and joining us today on Open Source RVA.
Sure thing, Don.
Jack Berry joins us. He's the executive director of Venture Richmond, a public-private entity that partners with the city through economic development, marketing, promotion, and advocacy. Among other things, Venture Richmond helps to produce the Richmond Folk Festival, the Second Street Festival, and many other events. Venture Richmond's also at the center of the controversy behind the demolition of the wall at Tredegar. Welcome, Jack. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks.
Let's get some basic facts out of the way. The property where the canal wall was demolished, that was Venture Richmond's property. Is that correct?
The property down there for many years has been owned by Newmarket Corporation. They actually own the Tredegar Civil War Center.
Mm-hmm.
They own their corporate headquarters site, and they own a site west of the Tredegar. And that was that site was donated to Venture Richmond in October of last year. The Second Street Connector Road was constructed, donated back to the city. So we now own it. We own about a 2.5 acre parcel that was remaining after the construction of the road.
Mm-hmm. And you owned it in October of last year when the demolition happened?
The demolition happened about a week after we took possession of it, and it was as big a surprise to me as it was to anybody else.
Right, right. They ruled recently, the Commonwealth's attorney and the police chief came out and ruled that this was an accident. But yet, it seems like there are a lot of facts behind this that haven't been brought out, and it just seems kind of strange to me. What was this contractor doing on that property in the first place?
Well, as I said, Newmarket owned the property before, mm-hmm. and they therefore owned the wall. And several years ago, they decided to demolish the wall that was on their property. They had received complaints from the city about homeless encampments and trash.
Mm-hmm.
They went out and looked at the wall. It was, in many cases, crumbling and in danger of falling over. So they decided to demolish the wall on their property, partly for that reason and partly to make way for the new connector road, which was going to slice through the wall. So they did that several years ago. They left about a 19-foot section on their property, on the far western end
mm-hmm.
Of their property. And they left that in place because I don't think they were real clear on exactly where their property line was because it hadn't been surveyed.
Right.
It's a confusing
bit of land. There are many, many owners who have little parcels here and there.
Right. There's the section of the wall behind Tredegar Ironworks,
mm-hmm.
and Tredegar is owned by Newmarket but licensed to the Civil War Center
right.
on a long-term basis. So I call that the Tredegar portion of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
That, too, is in disrepair, needs to be restored,
right.
but that is intact.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the section immediately west of that which Newmarket demolished several years ago. It's private property. They had a right to do that, of course.
Right, right.
And then you go a little further west than that, and it's owned by the city, the stretch between Newmarket's property, which is now mine, Venture Richmond's, that stretch, and the Lee Bridge. So
right.
there are sort of three ownerships now.
Okay.
Tredegar, Venture Richmond, and the city.
So, but who hired the contractor, and what work were they doing there?
Well, there, as I said, there was this 19-foot section that remained on Newmarket's property that had not been demolished. Apparently, the contractor thought he had permission to demolish that section.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, he did not have permission to demolish the section on city property further west, which is another, I don't know, 80 or 100 feet of wall.
Mm-hmm.
But to, you know, everyone's complete surprise, a week after I took possession of the property, this contractor shows up that I'd never even heard of, had no idea he was coming, had no idea that he planned to be on Venture Richmond's property, much less demolish a wall. And he demolished not only the 19 feet of wall that is on Venture Richmond's property, but the entire section further west on city property, you know, 80 to 100 feet of wall, came down as well. Various stories on how that happened, whether it collapsed on its own, whether it was, I think that's probably a stretch.
Yeah.
It was demolished, and whether or not it was demolished because of a safety issue or demolished because he planned to harvest the bricks, I don't know. But that's what happened to that section.
Well, giving some background to this, you're also thinking about building an amphitheater in this area. It seems like this demolition happened maybe at just the right or wrong time, depending on how you look at it. And many of the critics of what's happened would point that out. What do you say to that? And what do you say to some of the critics who think that, oh, Venture Richmond just decided to tear down this wall to build an amphitheater? Help build an
Well, the wall had been torn down, you know, at least 2 years before Venture Richmond came into the picture at all. At some point, the decision was made to build a connector road, and Newmarket, in its in a very generous, you know, way, decided to give the residual parcel to Venture Richmond. So we came to the scene late. We do have plans to develop an amphitheater on that site. It's the same site that's now used for the Community Foundation stage for the Folk Festival. And we plan to improve the grading of the site, improve the location of the stage, improve the parking area, provide other amenities, and basically a nice grassy slope up to the canal, and then restore the canal to what will approximate its original configuration as best we can tell from our archaeological work, and include the area above the canal up near Second Street near the War Memorial as sort of an upper tier to the amphitheater. So the amphitheater will in effect be enlarged. It will be both below the canal and above the canal. The canal will bisect it and create sort of the lower bowl where the good seats are and the upper tier where the cheap seats are.
Right, right. The idea that we need this amphitheater, where does that come from? Why do we need to build it, and why do we need to build it there? Give us some background on that.
Well, the Folk Festival has become enormously successful.
Right.
It will be in its ninth year this year, and last year with really great weather and a headliner named Roseanne Cash, we think we attracted almost 200,000 people over the weekend. The main stage, called the Altria Stage, which is on Newmarket's property up in that big field, we don't plan to use that anymore after this year. We'd like to consolidate the Folk Festival site down closer to the river on property that we own, the amphitheater site, on Tredegar property, as well as on city property on Browns Island. So
right.
we will be moving off of private property, which eventually is going to be developed in some way, we expect. It's Newmarket's property. They developed the Midwest
Veco site. It's a prime piece of land.
And just like the Midwest Veco site, over a long period of time, they have plans for development. So we want to get off the private property, get onto property that we control, so that we can make some permanent improvements like electrical connections and water connections, grade it properly, landscape it properly, so that we're in more of a plug-and-play situation with a folk festival.
Right.
So we're going to vacate the biggest site. We want to make the current amphitheater site bigger than it is today, mm-hmm. so it can accommodate more people. And then we have additional plans to develop a stage site on Tredegar's property and to expand a patio at the Tredegar complex for another stage. So we're trying to squeeze ourselves onto what property is available and still be able to accommodate the crowds. If you don't have enough space to accommodate the crowds, you can't invite them. Can't invite people down to the space is not big enough. So
we're a totally different event. It wouldn't be as comfortable.
We're doing everything we can to keep the folk festival going. That's our entire interest in this parcel, is to keep the folk festival alive.
Right. And I should say that I'm on the folk festival programming committee. And Jack, you've been really open with us about what you're doing, what you plan to do. And I know that you've been speaking to several different groups about what you plan to do. You had an original plan a year ago for this amphitheater, but you've revised that. You've scaled that back a bit, and you presented it to the Oregon Hill Neighborhood Association. Talk about what it was going to be and what it is now, your plan.
Well, I had a plan about a year ago, and it called for some fairly substantial modifications to the canal, which bisects the amphitheater, including filling it in partially and shaving the top off of the towpath mm-hmm. berm. There's the canal creates a big disconnect between the lower bowl and the upper bowl of the amphitheater. It's a problem from the standpoint of an amphitheater. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful historic resource, dates to George Washington's era. It's an incredibly important resource.
So you understand the concern that people have about this particular piece of land.
And I understand it a lot better now than I did then. So my original plan was to make some substantial changes, still retaining the canal, mm-hmm. But changing it somewhat, to make for the best possible amphitheater with the best possible sight lines for the folk festival. Well, that didn't receive a really warm reception, and so I've just done a lot of homework in the meantime. I've hired an archaeological firm, Dutton and Associates. We've done a lot of research on the property. We know a lot about the canal. We know about its original configuration, its dimensions, its height. And we know everything about that canal and that, mm-hmm. and that stretch. And so I've been to the Historic Richmond Foundation, the Department of Historic Resources for the state, been to the City Planning Department. I've made my second trip to the Oregon Hill Association this week to talk to them about the revised plan. And the revised plan is quite different from the original in that we are now proposing to restore the canal to approximate its original configuration. Mm-hmm. So right now, the top of the towpath is about 25 feet wide. Mm-hmm. Well, originally it was only 12 feet wide. Mm-hmm. Sometime in the 1870s, it was widened. Well, we're going to take it back to its original width. At some point along the way, a railroad was put on top of it, and a big mound of dirt was brought in on top of it.
Yeah.
So it's higher now than it was originally. So instead of being 84 and a half feet above sea level as it is now, we're going to take it back to 83 feet above sea level. We're going to shave 1.5 feet off the top of it and remove the railroad line.
I was going to ask
line.
You about the tracks, yeah.
And we believe that 83 feet above sea level was the original height. So that towpath is going to look, we think, exactly or as close to it as we can to what it looked like mm-hmm. when George Washington surveyed it.
Right.
The width of the canal itself will be the same.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom will not be filled in. The water depth, if there's ever going to be water in it again, would be the same.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to create a situation where we can maintain it and mow the banks and make the banks safe so you don't fall in. You can,
yeah.
If you're a kid and you're coming to the folk festival, you're going to roll into the
right.
to the bottom,
yeah.
not fall
Parker
into
Parker Agelasto
it.
Was here, and that was one of his main concerns.
Yeah, we want it to be safe. We want it to be something that can be maintained, and we want to interpret it. We want signage. We want people to come see it. We mm-hmm. want people to learn about the canal as it was originally built, whereas right now it's a dangerous jungle. You can't get anywhere near it because of the overgrowth.
Mm-hmm.
It's got probably a foot of water in it today after all the rain. Usually in the summer and in fall it's dry. But we want to create a canal that looks very much like it looked back then, perhaps mm-hmm. putting some sort of surface on the top of the towpath so that you can walk and ride your bike, mm-hmm. some sort of crushed aggregate stone or whatever was would approximate what was there originally, mm-hmm. so that it can be a bike path and pedestrian path,
right.
Connecting hopefully all the way to the North Bank bike trail that takes you to Maymont and connecting to the east to the connector road. So we've got plans to make what we hope will be a really nice grassy slope, which some people, including me, call an amphitheater, and as well as improving the canal and restoring it to its original condition.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually more like interested in the reaction to the wall coming down than anything, and how it seems as though the police ignored or otherwise disregarded this for a while, and then all of a sudden popped up and said it was an accident, but there were no real details surrounding it. Is that just bad police work, or is this something that we should be concerned about as we look at our historic resources? Obviously, we don't want people just willy-nilly going out and destroying these things.
Yeah, I think people were outraged because city property was destroyed without permission.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm more disturbed that we don't know like hard details about that destruction and who might have been responsible for it. You know?
I don't know what kind of investigation has been done to determine who the responsible parties are. Nobody's interviewed me. Mm-hmm. I'm the owner of the property.
Right, right. See, that tells me that wasn't much of an investigation. For instance, why aren't we pulling the contract from the contractor and finding out who officially hired him to be out there?
If there was a contract.
Right, but do contractors just go around willy-nilly just working on stuff? Or, I mean, maybe they do, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I'd never heard of Leasefield before. Mm-hmm. I was called by some city officials and said, come down here, somebody's on your property and our property getting ready to steal bricks.
Mm-hmm. You don't need a key? You don't need a key to get on the property?
I don't know if... There is a fence that's gated at the bottom, and I don't know if you can get to it without a key or not. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. But do you see where that only feeds into the notion that this was sort of just done and then covered up?
Yeah, I would love for there to be closure to this in a mm-hmm. way that people understand all the facts, and I'm telling you what I knew.
Right.
And so that we can move on. I mean,
yeah,
ideally,
yeah, yeah.
Tredegar has the wall at the back of their property, and it's about to fall down, and it's missing a lot of bricks, and they're trying to, they've got a donor that is going to help them to restore it. They're going to need a lot of bricks.
Mm-hmm.
The bricks from the demolished wall would be great to be used for that project so
yeah.
that we could actually restore that wall with
original
bricks.
I assume that was what was going to happen. Do you know if that's the case?
I don't know what was going to happen to the bricks. All I know is that the Tredegar folks have a need for bricks, and these are original bricks to mm-hmm. the original wall, and it would be very helpful to provide those bricks to Tredegar so that they could restore their wall, because that wall is definitely worth saving.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that the wall that was torn down is worth putting back up.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You know, there's some discussion about just how historic this wall and this area.
Well, it was a historic wall, no doubt. Built after the Civil War, probably in the 1870s, about 8 feet tall. It was a very handsome wall. It had some architectural detail. If you look at the wall behind Tredegar, it's the same design, and it was a beautiful wall, but it was mm-hmm. about to fall down. And Tredegar's wall is in disrepair, and they want to restore it.
Mm-hmm. It'd
be great if they could do it with real bricks instead of have to bring in new bricks
yeah.
and do some sort of half-assed job. So I'm going to donate the bricks that are on my property, on Venture Richmond's property, the 19 feet of bricks
yeah.
that were demolished on Venture Richmond's property. I'm going to donate all those bricks to Tredegar. I don't know what the city will do with its piece,
mm-hmm.
whether they will donate the bricks or whether they will... try to rebuild the wall. If they try to rebuild the wall, so many of the bricks were destroyed in the process of the demolition that
mm-hmm.
They'll end up using a lot of new bricks. So I'm not sure if that adds a lot of value, but it's completely up to them.
Mm-hmm. Where does the amphitheater idea go from here? You've presented it to, I guess, the Neighborhood Association and the city. The city has seen it as well.
I've presented it to the city planning department.
Gotcha.
Yes. So I need lots of permits.
Yeah.
I need a Corps of Engineers permit if we touch the wetlands, which are at the bottom of the canal,
mm-hmm.
Even though they're isolated wetlands. So we'll need a permit from them. In order to get a permit from them, we need the concurrence of the Department of Historic Resources, which is a state agency. We'll also need approval from the city's Urban Design Committee if any part of the amphitheater is on city property, and we do plan to use some of the city property for the amphitheater. We lease some city property from the city that we'd like to use for the amphitheater, so that'll involve the city Urban Design Committee and the Planning Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be going through a city approval process, a state approval process with the Historic Resources folks, and a federal approval process with the Corps of Engineers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told that all this is going to take at least 6 months. There'll be lots of public meetings. And so nothing will be done in the cover of darkness. So this is going to be a wide open, very, very thoughtfully considered plan over the next 6 months that will involve a lot of public input. I think this amphitheater plan is going to stand the test of scrutiny by all the groups. The fact that we're being so respectful of the canal and are going to make it into a wonderful historic resource is the fact that we're taking a jungle and making a park out of it on the riverfront with spectacular views. I think it's going to be a real asset to the city, and I fully expect that we'll have the support of all of these groups.
Well, you're listening to Open Source RVA. I'm Don Harrison, and I've been speaking with Jack Berry, the executive director of Venture Richmond. We've been talking about the demolition of the historic wall at Tredegar. For more information on Venture Richmond, you can go to VentureRichmond.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Thanks for coming, Jack.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, July 26th. Thank you again for letting us share space with the other little voices in your head. I'm Chris Dovey. My co-host is Don Harrison. The Richmond Public Media News team is Brittany Tracy, Cameron Vigliano, and Onofrio Castiglia. Our producers are Gabby Scardust and Jay Westerman. Our personal school board representative over here at Open Source is Dr. Mike McKenzie. Challenge his credentials and face a mighty smiting. To confirm Dr. McKenzie's curriculum vitae, head on over to rvaopensource.com to download this and past episodes of Open Source. While you're there, please click the Donate Now button and give generously. Your money will be open source tested, but doctor approved. And remember to email us your news tips at opensourcerva@gmail.com. Hearing no objections, I declare this meeting of Open Source RVA adjourned.